Thank you. You may be seated. And good morning to everyone. We will begin this morning with introductions from the court. I am Mike Havikin, the Chief Justice, and by order of seniority as to service on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning. I'm Lindsay Miller Lerman.
Good morning, William Castle.
Good morning, Jeff Funk.
Jonathan Pappas, morning.
I should note that Justice Stacy is recused in this matter. Counsel, this is the case of Melton versus City of Holdridge. And Mr. Bennett, are you with us here today? Good morning to you, sir. And Mr. Dudley, are you here today? Good morning to you. Counsel, when you are at counsel table or other folks in the courtroom, please keep your mask on. When you are presenting to the court, please take your mask off so that we can hear and understand what you have to say. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin? Very good then, Mr. Bennett, you may approach and you may proceed.
Very good. Good morning. Todd Bennett on behalf of the appellant, Ben Melton. This is a case that is dealing with an amputation below the knee, and that's the focus of whether we have a loss of a foot, the loss of all toes, and a loss of use of the remaining residual leg. There's five allegations of errors, and the first one deals with the court's assessment of a 20% loss of use of the leg. What the court found, he improperly considered the use of the prosthetic. What the court specifically said, with the use of the prosthetic, he can walk, he can do incline and declines, climb, he can do uneven terrain, and generally support the use of the prosthetic. The case of Calhorn and Otto clearly set forth that's improper. Every loss of use is determined uncorrected and unaided. That has been the law for several years, and that's the way it is. The court simply missed that. The reason is because the loss of use, even though you evaluate that, it's not ruled out even though the correction's achieved. And the logic is what the Supreme Court said, you don't evaluate an eye with a corrective lens because we see no logic of treating a leg after a prosthetic or appliance is attached. The court clearly erred in that regard because the plain meaning is he can't do his job without the prosthetic. He can't do any past relevant work without the prosthetic. That is a plain error as a matter of law. The next issue goes to, then, what is the loss of use of that leg? The case is Jacob. Jacob adopted the test for all practical intents and purposes. What is usefulness? Usefulness is how you industrially use that body member to the performance of work. Without the prosthetic, Mr. Melton testified numerous examples. He can't do that. It's undisputed. What the issue in this court is, what the court did in its decision and what the defendant and the appellee did on cross-examination, they minutely fragmentized the significance of the loss of the physical function ability to work when they asked every question focused on the use of the prosthetic. In the case of Meade, that court specifically said, it's rejected. We are not going to minutely fragmentize that injury because the issue is undisputed. The destroyed function of a physical ability, which is indispensable to the performance of work, that's the focus. I'm not going to go over the numerous examples of Mr. Melton's testimony because he lost his center of gravity, he lost his agility, his coordination, it's lost. And according to the court of me, Jeffers, and Jacobs, for all practical intents and purposes, that loss of use is total. The court erred in not even following or acknowledging that test, let alone the testimony without the use of the prosthetic. The third issue resolves around 48.121 subsection 3. It's our contention the court erred in not awarding 70 weeks, which is set forth in the statute, for all missing toes. The defendant's going to argue that that's a double recovery. The statute doesn't allow for it. Its premise, the court specifically stated the operative language in that statute, in any case where there's a loss or loss of use for more than one member or more than one parts of a member, not amounting to permanent total disability. And that's the key. And I'll get to that in a minute. but not amounting to total disability, each member or part thereof, you're entitled to compensation for each member or part thereof for the period to run consecutively. The court bypasses that. They go straight to the language that says the amputation between the knee and the ankle is the equivalent of the loss of a foot. And the reason the court erred as a matter of law, they skipped the two sentences before that. The first sentence is total loss of two members, any two thereof, of two hands, two feet, two arms, constitutes total disability as a matter of law. The reason that's important is the next section is, if it's not meeting that guideline, every other, any case dealing with two thereof, it's in accordance with the facts, whether permanent total disability has been sustained. The language, whether it's equivalent, the amputation between the knee and the foot is equivalent to a foot, that is only merely descriptive of what injury qualifies for a two-member injury in the same accident, permanent and total disability has been sustained. And the reason that is why the court erred is because this court in Runyon set forth a gentleman with four missing fingers on each hand, you don't get two-member total disability because fingers are not a member. And what the legislature or the court in Runyon said, the legislature specifically said, if we were going to eliminate toes and fingers, number one, you would have put it in the list of classes of injury. Number two, you would have fixed the place at time the loss of those toes would have equaled the foot. The legislature did neither. And what the court specifically found, the obvious intent is to compensate each member or part thereof when total disability has not been sustained. That's why Mr. Melton is entitled to the 150 weeks for his foot, in addition to the toes of 70 weeks. That statute has been around, and that's what's being used. And I'll give you an example. If you amputate your big toe, you have an ankle fusion, you have a total knee replacement, and then you have a femur fracture resulting in complex regional pain. What the trial court simply did in that scenario, well, if the rule stands, you're going to combine all those and say you only get 215 for the leg. That's not what the statute said. There's no limitation. There's no prohibition. You're entitled to each member or part thereof. And the court erred as a matter of law. Then comes the penalty.
If we disagree with your statutory interpretation, do you have any quarrel with the factual findings made by the trial court?
As to the toes?
As to the left leg.
Well, as to the left leg, that's a loss of use. That's totally separate than the total loss.
Then as to the toes and the foot, what I'm trying to get at, you're making a statutory argument. It's premised on a reading of the statute that contains multiple parts, and we have to construe it as a sensible whole. Assuming that we disagree with your interpretation of the statute, what does that do, if anything, to the court's factual findings?
The factual finding still results. The court didn't state any fact what the use is without the prosthetic. None. Absolutely none. Which means the factual finding is improper. The factual finding of what Mr. Melton testified without the prosthetic, that was undisputed. Not the court, not the appellee, they didn't ask anything about that. So as far as that finding, it still supports Melton's argument, even if we follow the statutory construction, because it's undisputed. But the next issue is the penalty on the late payment of the foot. It took the defendant 5.5 years, and what should be mindful of this court are the findings that did not get appealed or argued or disputed. It took 5.5 years between 2012 and 2017 to finally make it that payment. That payment was based on the premise the defendant wanted the gold standard. They wanted an expert opinion. Tell us he's at MMI. What the court did is come up with a new rule based on the existing law and said, I find permanency for the loss of that foot commences when TTD is or temporary is discontinued or MMI, whichever comes first. The problem with what the court did, that was not my full argument. MMI is defined as plateauing, reaching as good as you're going to get, not getting better or worse. The significant evidence, what follows is Exhibit 2 in this trial, McGowan, Dr. McGowan, Seven times says he's stable in MMI from June 12, 2012 through October 2012 through February 14. Dr. Suleiman in Exhibit 3 said it twice in 2012 and 2014. Most importantly, April 2nd of 14, the prosthetician who fitted 67 prostheses finally says it's a mature residual leg. It's a below the knee amputation that's mature, not getting better, not getting worse, and plateaued. But the defendant simply said, no, not now, not yet. What they wanted is the gold standard. The second argument why the court erred as a matter of fact and law is a duty to investigate. Exhibit one, I provided a demand to the defendant. January 2017, gave him a picture. They've already had the records from Dr. Shear, Suleiman, and McGowan in those exhibits. The defendant ignored it. I demanded the payment again in February, ignored it. Then finally, the doctor, Shear, in Exhibit 8, comes back with a medical report. Then they pay. There's no reasonable controversy. They knew the foot was gone. They went 214 weeks over a 4.5-year period without paying a benefit. It was due. There's no obligation for a medical report when it's obvious, it's objective. Everybody knew, clear back in 2011 when this accident happened, the foot was gone. Now the last issue is voc rehab. He's only working because of a correction. He's only working with that correction that you should be evaluating unaided, uncorrected. If that fails for pressure point pain or phantom pain, he can't do his job. The order for voc rehab should have been entered. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Dudley, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, David Dudley on behalf of the appellee.
And you may take the mask off.
Now I can actually see people. You know, it took a half an hour for the tinting to go away, and now I can deal with the fog as well. Thank you, Your Honor. For the appellee, the City of Holdridge, I think it's important to unpack a little bit what Mr. Bennett has argued on behalf of the appellant. There are essentially three issues, I think, that this court needs to look at. Issue number one is, to what extent is this court going to stretch beyond belief, from my perspective, 48, 121 in parens 3, about what permanent disability benefits an employee who has sustained an amputation receives. There was some discussion from Mr. Bennett with respect to, you got to ignore the fact that he has a prosthetic. You have to add permanent partial disability benefits for the amputation of the toes, which is 70 weeks, with permanent partial disability benefits for the foot, which is another 150 weeks. Plus, you have to take into consideration that there's also a complete loss of the leg. And as I understand the argument, and I think it's laid out pretty clearly in the brief that was submitted on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Bennett, on behalf of his client, is alleging that he's entitled to 435 weeks of permanent partial disability benefits for the loss of the leg. That completely strains 48.121 in parens 3. The next issue this court has to deal with is, to what extent did Judge Block and the lower court make an appropriate determination that there was a reasonable controversy with respect to this issue? And thirdly, Your Honors, I think the court has an opportunity to clarify an issue for which I don't think there's any law. And I think the court below recognized that at this particular time, there's not any clear direction from any appellate court with respect to what an employer is supposed to do when they have an employee who has an amputation and who is treating and who occasionally is requiring the payment of temporary disability benefits. What's the obligation? How does it work? What should be done? And there really is no direction with respect to that issue. And I think it's helpful, frankly, that we have an appeal and that this court picked up this particular case, because we can now, I think, get some clarification with respect to that issue. And looking at the confusion, I think, that exists for practitioners in the workers' compensation world and also workers' compensation judges, I would encourage someone to look at the Lefferholtz decision. It has zero precedential value for this court, has zero precedential value for anybody who's practicing in the Nebraska Workers' Compensation Court, but it is an indication of, I think, the confusion that exists with respect to this issue. In that particular case, as in this case, we had an amputation. We had an individual who went back to work on and off. We had an individual who ultimately a year and a half after the amputation was finally paid permanent disability benefits. At the time, there was a determination by a doctor that that person had reached maximum medical improvement. Both the trial judge in that Lefferholz case and the three judges on the review panel all determined that Nebraska law is pretty hard and fast. Before someone reaches maximum medical improvement, you get temporary disability benefits. After you reach maximum medical improvement, you can only receive permanent disability benefits. And that apparent hard and fast rule creates problems, I think, in trying to determine what benefits someone who has sustained an amputation should be receiving. Because it is clear, Mr. Melton had an amputation. It was a traumatic amputation. It was apparent that week that that leg wasn't ever going to be reattached. But the point is, at what, when does this magic point that we tend to focus on in the workers' compensation world, when does that point exist for purposes of an amputation injury? And I think what Judge Block did in the underlying court was appropriately identify a rule that fits within, I think, some of the other legal authorities that have been handed down by this and other courts, which allows for us to make a determination that at a particular point in time, when there's no more when there's a point where no more temporary disability benefits are being paid, then you pick up the payment of the permanent partial disability, regardless of whether the patient is, the employee is still treating, regardless of whether that particular individual is at maximum medical improvement.
From a policy standpoint, why is that preferable?
It's preferable because I think, as identified in the lower court, at that particular point in time, the employer knows that it's time to start picking up the payment of the permanent disability benefits. And on behalf of the employee knows that at a point when they are no longer receiving the temporary disability, or they are not being actually paid temporary disability benefits and before maximum medical improvement, there's going to be an additional income stream. And you don't have circumstances like we have in this case. I think that's the public policy. And I think that's why this court has an opportunity to adopt that rule moving forward, Your Honor. The other argument that was raised by the appellant is that somehow in determining what disability benefits should be paid, you have to ignore the fact that there's a prosthetic that's been used. And I think you have to look at that argument and kind of turn it around, because really the argument is, if you considered the prosthetic device when you're assessing the loss of use of the leg, there would be significantly less than 100% impairment, or 100%, because with the use of the prosthetic, Mr. Melton is very functional. I mean, he testified, there's references in the record to the extent to which he's very productive, he's making a very good living. And so if you considered the prosthetic device in trying to determine the percentage of the loss of use of the leg, it would be significantly less, I submit, than 100%. But we don't do that. The leg is gone. The statute is clear. We're not looking at when the court below made a determination that we had a complete loss of the foot, that was without taking into consideration the prosthetic device. And I disagree with the underlying court's determination that in addition to the complete loss of the foot, there was also an additional 20% impairment to the lower extremity. But that was an issue that the court resolved. I think it was, there were facts upon which the court could make that determination.
Do you believe that the appellant's reading of the trial court's decision is a fair reading as to the prosthesis?
I'm not sure I even understand how appellant interprets the decision that was made by the court, Your Honor. But I think that from my perspective, Mr. Melton has been compensated completely, and he's been compensated more benefits than he arguably could have been entitled to for the lower extremity. I think this notion that the court erred below because it didn't give 70 weeks of benefits for the toes plus the 150 weeks for the foot plus an additional 215 weeks for the lower extremity, if that's the argument, again, that completely strains and blows up 48.1.21 in Prince 3 and how we determine and compensate people that have sustained injuries to their lower extremities. The other issue, Your Honors, that bears some discussion is, in fact, this whether or not there was a reasonable controversy with respect to the timing of the payment of permanent disability benefits. One of the things that the court did take a look at is trying to determine what information was available when with respect to whether Mr. Melton had reached maximum medical improvement. Court looked at that issue. There was no evidence with respect to whether before the payment of the permanent partial disability benefits, there's no evidence that indicates that my client had information regarding maximum medical improvement before Dr. Scheer provided that information in the spring of 2018. And because of that, Your Honor, the determination that the court below made is subject to that higher standard of review. There is, and furthermore, Your Honors, there is no specific rule with respect to, that clarifies under what set of circumstances and when permanent disability benefits are to be paid. And because of that, Your Honor, we're here requesting that this court adopt a new rule. And because of that, inherently, there is a reasonable controversy because of a lack of legal authority for that particular proposition.
Do you wish to speak to the vocational rehabilitation issue?
Yes, I can briefly, Your Honor. The record reflects that at the time of the trial, Mr. Melton was earning roughly 30 or 40% more than he was at the time he was injured working for the city of Holdridge. There was no evidence that there was a process where 48163.01 was put in place and someone was discussing what efforts needed to be made to try and get Mr. Melton back to work. That just didn't happen. And certainly moving forward, there is no evidence that would support a determination that he's entitled to vocational rehabilitation because he is appropriately employed. Right now, I'm not even aware of any specific restrictions or limitations that the record reflects apply to Mr. Melton and his ability to work in the future. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. Counsel, that concludes arguments in Melton versus City of Holdridge. Maintain those masks as you are leaving, and please leave by the side door in the court.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.